Hello, welcome to the Creighton Crowbar. This is episode 80. It's the 17th of February. I'm Tom Francis, and here with me today are...
Marsh Davis, hello.
And...
Tom Senior.
And Tom, you just got back from ParadoxCon.
ParadoxCon.
A place where nothing makes any sense.
No, apart from it's full of wizards and people doing strategy at each other in turns. Continuous strategy with pause functions. That's what they like.
That sounds so debauched.
That's their thing. It was pretty hot, I must admit. We were in the hotel place where the entire event took place. It was a converted prison.
Hmm.
So our rooms were all old cells that had been converted into little bunks. And then we were kind of ushered out every day at 9 a.m. to play extremely obtuse strategy games. Which was fucking amazing. That's all I want to do ever. So it was pretty happy.
Where are they based, sorry, did you say?
Stockholm.
Oh, right.
That's which is where Paradox are actually, their main offices are based.
Mm.
Including Paradox South and Paradox North. Paradox South is named so because it's in the south of their big office building. Paradox North is named so because it's above Paradox South physically on the floor above.
It's Galactic North.
Yeah, it's Galactic North. but it was actually, they showed off, they announced nothing new, which was amusing because they said the theme of the conference was transparency. And then someone asked, what are you working on? And said, we can't talk about that.
Brilliant.
That's the paradox.
Living up to their name, definitely. But it did mean I got to play some juicy things. That I'm going to be careful about what I talk about because some of it is embargoed, I can't remember. But I can talk about Cities Skylines. It's the embargo for today.
I heard someone say that was the game that SimCity should have been.
Yeah, I mean, that's desperately what they want you to think about it, because the UI...
Maybe it was a marketing person for SimCity.
Yeah.
Is that in the same series as the other Cities games? Like, I think Cities in Motion is another one?
I think
or
so.
Cities XL?
So the devs from Motion are working on this.
Ah, right.
It's not the same series, it's kind of basically just, you know, they've gone in from scratch to... and it looks exactly like SimCity in terms of the user interface, in that, you know, if you place a building that makes people happy, you'll get that amazing shockwave of happy faces spreading across your city. They've just lifted all that stuff directly, which is fine because it works really, really well. And the best thing about SimCity was the fucking interface, which is just beautiful. The good thing about this is that it kind of works, as opposed to SimCity, which kind of, had its flaws that kind of became suddenly painfully apparent after about 9 or 10 hours of playing it. And until that point, it's like really fun. SimCity is very much attacked, but if you want to pay £5 and get 9 hours of reasonably good city building, like, honestly, Maxis SimCity is quite nice. But this one fixes everything that, people found wrong with that one. So, the cities are still on big square plots. Once you've got enough money, you just buy a big square adjacent plot and continue expanding.
Nice.
Up to 9 tiles, which is fucking enormous. Like, you get a huge amount of space. You've got curved roads. The traffic isn't broken from what I played of it. I played about 2 hours, and it kind of visually represents the traffic very nicely, and you can see where the jams are happening. But everything doesn't grind to a halt if there's like a weird kind of AI bug that causes people to get stuck into each other, which is what happened with SimCity, where like fire engines couldn't get out of fire stations because of traffic, and then everything burned down even though you had 10 fire stations. So they're all traffic locked.
Does it simulate every citizen individually? Like, do they have homes and jobs?
You can click on every citizen individually and it'll give you their name and their job and how old they are and stuff, and you can tag them and follow them around and even rename them. And so, like, someone found a dog.
Kind of a jerk mayor. your name is now Bob.
So there are animals, and you can rename them as well in the forest.
That animal's called James now.
that's the omniscient power of the mayor in the city skylines, is that you can just point to any living creature and rename it to according to your own whim.
Sounds like something from Death Note, but like a really shitty version of Death Note.
Yeah. It's very hard to tell. Like, I don't think it does it must kind of fudge it somewhere.
If you can't tell, that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't care if I can't follow a citizen to work and back, really, as long as the overall simulation works.
But wasn't that a problem with Maxis' SimCity, that it wasn't fully simulating things, and because of a result of that was causing the traffic jams, because citizens would just have like a percentage chance just to go to a home, even if it wasn't theirs, and that was causing like...
I think they got in the jams because everyone was simulated, in that they had to physically get from home to a place of work and order for any business to happen.
Hmm.
But yeah, they didn't care which home they went to and which business they went to. They just went to like the nearest one. And that was obviously a simplification for, you know, I don't know, efficiency purposes, I guess, to make it simpler and to avoid the kind of horrible jams that they ended up getting into. And yet it also kind of ruins the thing about clicking on someone and seeing where they go to know that they're not actually going to their real home.
Yeah. It makes it kind of pointless. Like, we were saying at the time about SimCity, if they just replaced all the cars with a texture that was sometimes denser than sometimes not, which is what old SimCities used to do, then that actually just communicates everything the player needs to know. The numbers are still crunching underneath it.
Because if you don't do that, it's just City.
So basically, it's got modding support as well, which is an offline, you can run offline, which is obviously the major thing that people hated about SimCity.
They're smart to make one, because if you're making a city building game now, you can just get three or four really easy big wins, kind of. But let's not just not fuck that up, and not fuck that up, and not fuck that up. That's three up on SimCity.
That should be the tagline of Skylines, is that we didn't fuck this, or this up. And that they haven't, by the looks of it. It was super fun from what I played. But
I wouldn't put it past Paradox's marketing guys to actually take that.
You can have that one for free, guys.
It's as we're talking about it, I realise there's actually a pretty close precedent for what happened with SimCity, in that they wanted this thing of simulating each individual citizen, and to do that, they got themselves in all kinds of like traffic problems that caused your city to kind of fail, even where you set it up pretty reasonably. And B, they said that was the reason it had to be these small plots of land, and you can expand beyond it, because it was just too much work to kind of simulate all those individual people. And Supreme Commander 2, the reason the maps are so much smaller than that, everything's just on a much, much smaller scale than Supreme Commander 1, was actually because of their pathfinding. They have this neat little thing for pathfinding where if you have two battalions of tanks and they want to go past each other, they called it flow field technology, and they kind of flowed almost like a liquid, so that each one would kind of find its path, but they would also like smoothly rejoin their formation as soon as they could. Whereas in the old Supreme Commander, it's true, if you've got two formations to clash into each other, each individual tank will kind of bump into one, stop, turn around a little bit, try and go around it one way, and just dumbly bump into it again. And Chris Taylor is obviously really keen on this, and one of the downsides of that was it just took up a lot of memory. So it wasn't like a CPU time thing, it just took up a lot of space in the memory, and that was the thing you need if you want really big maps. And he said he thought that was a good trade-off, and wasn't. I mean, it was pretty nice pathfinding. I really like Supreme Commander 2 in its own way, but it's certainly fair to say that the reduction in map size was one of the key things that kicked the community off against it and made it become a kind of like, just was rejected by most of the hardcore fans, it seemed like. So don't get too hung up on one feature and sacrifice everything else for that. That's my advice to designers everywhere.
With this kind of an element of just making a beautiful, neat thing to City Skylines, in that if you try and be too creative and move outside of the block structure, you're basically building something inefficient. It wants you to make perfectly sized blocks in order to win. And it's kind of I wish there was almost a mode where it didn't incentivize you so much to be so, like, Borg-like in the construction of your cities. Because I found myself just trying building a big spirally loopy thing, and it wasn't making much money. I was, like, happy with my big stupid spiral, but sad because I couldn't build anything else because the money wasn't coming in fast enough, and ended up having to build the Borg town to the southeast, where, you know, everything was Borgy and beautiful and incredibly, you know, rich and verdant, and that funded my insane, like, spiraling sky cities on the other side of the map. and I kind of want to build the stupid spirally sky cities without having to have the giant factory, basically.
I love that sort of like, it's your dirty little secret. How does this town work? It seems so elaborate and fanciful and not efficiency based. Oh, well, there's just a really efficient town over there. We just take all their money.
Borg South, that's funding the entire escapade.
I mean, that's kind of, it reminds me of how I built my SimCity in the last iteration of that, which was figured out pretty quickly that like pollution is a really big deal and happiness goes down around industrial stuff. So my city was just like a road that spanned the entire block, like the square of land I was allowed to work with at one end just all industrial stuff all along that same one road, and at the other end all residential stuff all along that same road. Just a massive one road town.
Yeah.
What else did you see? Anything you can talk about?
Magicka 2.
Is that good?
It's so much fun.
You see, I really like Magicka, but it was broken as fuck when I wanted to play it, and it just didn't work online, unfortunately.
Yeah, QA is one of the things that, like, every team
Every year they say that. They've said that for at least the last 4 years.
They say it every year, but they showed us like diagrams of how their teams are structured. In fact,
they showed us diagrams this time.
Yeah, four QA people to each project. They're very small teams, actually, for their development studio does.
It's not Arrowhead making Magicka 2, though, is it, right? I thought they'd, which implied emotion about this. I think they've now taken ownership, let's say, of the Magicka franchise.
I think Arrowhead
have gone on. They were meant to make Gauntlet, so I think
they're... they're doing their own things. Like, Magicka 2, it's very similar to the first game. Like, it's the same elements and the same mechanic in that you... press keys on your keyboard to summon blobs of these elements and then right-click or left-click or shift-click to, cast the spells by merging the elements, which is just a brilliant system, actually, from the first game. It encourages a kind of manic, quite skillful approach to high-level challenges. And the good thing about the fights we did in Magicka 2 was that the enemies had certain resistances to certain elements, so you were encouraged to say, oh, these guys are good at fire, bring out the ice beams, and everyone suddenly channels their ice beams. When multiple beams converge and they're the same beam, they could become, like, they deflect off each other and become increasingly powerful. So you get these absurd, beautiful laser displays as everyone deploys this ice beam against the giant fire monster, and then a load of ice dudes come in and everyone just brings out flamethrower spells and, goes to work. The cool thing about Magicka 2 is that there are these really neat modifiers, like rule modifiers you can add, which could do anything from increasing your wizard speed to 300%, or monster speeds to 300%, or making it so that you can't move if you're casting spells, or making certain elements more powerful or less powerful, or making it so that when you kill an enemy, you teleport to where they were when they died, making death cause explosions or cause implosions that suck people in. Just a huge array of these things. And there are plenty of good joke ones as well, like a laughter track that you could turn on, things like that.
How are these, like, in the options menu or the items you find? Or?
No, they're, I can't remember what their stupid term for it was, but you basically go into the a separate menu and turn them on and off.
It's like Unreal Tournament mutators.
Yeah, it's exactly that ethos that it's tapping into. And whether they realise that directly, like I got a real kind of Perfect Dark vibe from it, because when I used to play Perfect Dark on the N64, it was all about the rule sets that my friends made, and we all agreed to play together locally, and Magicka 2 really taps into that. So I was just in a couch with three other journalists, and we settled on a rule set we really liked and found challenging and balanced for ourselves. So we had 300% speed, so we were all zipping around like mad road idiots. But we had to stop to cast spells, a la early. There's a risk reward to, stopping to cast a big thing and then moving out of the way. And it was great. Absolutely.
It's a single player game. Because they put out Wizard Wars, didn't they? Which is like them sword pseudo MOBA.
Yeah, that's kind of an arena co-op battler thing with sort of PvP modes attached to it, I think. You play it in single player, but it's designed as a co-op game primarily. So I think there'll be co-op missions and things.
But it's a linear kind of narrative thing.
But with lots of arena modes. So we played lots of arena modes basically, where you fight off waves of enemies. And the consistency of the waves changes depending on the map that you choose. It's kind of hard to really elucidate, like to really develop thoughts on it because it's so similar to the first game. But the first game is fucking great once you got past the kind of broken elements. Like after when the bugs were eventually fixed.
Oh, yeah.
I had some fantastic times in co-op with it. And this is promising.
I feel like I'm almost more interested in playing single player because the thing I liked was just experimenting, and I just spend like half an hour just standing in one spot with no enemies even around. I can like summon up these orbs and then turn them into healing orbs, but then protect myself with arcane and then throw it down and around myself, then I blow myself up. Or if I combine this beam and this like stream of steam and then this other thing and then attach it to my sword, then this happens.
It's mean stuff like if there's a river in the middle of the map, like you get wet and then away electricity enemies will come out from a load of houses and water plus electricity means almost instant death. Or you can just get yourself wet and then accidentally cast a fire, like an electric spell on yourself. There's an amazing scope for malfunction in the mechanics, especially in co-op, that just makes it really, really, really funny. It's a wizardy farce, which I love. Very colourful as well.
Yeah, there aren't that many good slapstick games.
No.
I don't think, but that is one, certainly.
Hmm.
Did you get a cape while you were out at Paradox?
I wore one of the Paradox capes just for 30 seconds, because they all seem to have capes.
Because it's very cold out there this time of year.
Yeah, it was actually unseasonably warm for the time.
Oh, right,
it was
okay.
Lovely. But yeah, it was a thick velvet cloak, and gave me plus one awesome. Temporarily, while I wore it. I took it off because I was too hot. yeah, they've got a lot of costumes. Paradox, a lot of wizardy robe costumes, which they use to make their trailers and things. And they like to try and make these viral comedy trailers. And yeah, they're quite a cute company, really.
Yeah,
I do quite well. They're up to about like 150, 170 staff now. After
don't worry.
And they're publishing Pillars of Eternity.
I didn't know.
Yep, and they've got quite a lot of games on the go. So the futures.
Hmm. Well, they've got a very loyal base of people who are, you're never going to shed people who are, the Europa Universalis crowd are, I imagine, they're only going to get their kicks from Paradox, aren't they?
Yeah. Where else do you go, man?
Yeah.
they're the awesome ghetto for people who love those nerdy strategy games, which I do too. And they kind of, like, Crusader Kings 2 is amazing. It's one of the best strategy games in the last 5-10 years. Its ability to create stories is just extraordinary. And the idea that it's this platform, and every 6 months or a year they release another expansion that just kind of makes it more detailed and a better simulation. Mm. Like, such a good model. Like, you buy the game once and you've got all this kind of 10 years of entertainment there for you. which is really cool. Also the Game of Thrones mod. Which apparently, talking to Fred Wester, their CEO, he had an appointment with George R.R. Martin back in 2005
to talk about
licensing the Game of Thrones. Wow. License before it became the HBO show,
but they did publish the game by Cyanide, didn't they? Paradox.
They did was that the shitty muddy 3D RPG thing?
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called.
No, I can't remember either. But they're nowhere near the license now. Mm. But you said, like you said, that's the one license they would consider pursuing. I think they don't like the idea of giving licensee too much creative control over everything they're doing, because they're quite team led. But yeah, that's the one thing you would consider.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Apparently, they were quite HBO were slightly distressed about the Game of Thrones mod.
Oh, really?
When it came out, because
it's better than all of their efforts.
So far, yeah, definitely. Because Kotaku ran an article saying that the best Game of Thrones game is actually a mod.
Right.
And HBO saw that. And then he said, wait, you guys make any money from this? Are you kind of using it to sell your game? And they're like, no, we didn't write it. But I'm sure they're very happy that that perception is out there.
Yeah.
Anyway, what have you been playing, Tom?
I have totally relapsed on 868 Hack, which is the hacking roguelike by Michael Bro, who did Vertex Dispenser and Crypt and this. He's done loads of games, but I think those are the best known. And it came out on mobile ages ago. And in fact, even before that, there was... I can't remember if this was public. I think there was a public free PC version. And certainly I played on PC. I think maybe it was in the IGF. Or maybe there was just a public version that I played. And I liked it at the time, and then I kind of forgot about it when it came out on mobile. Maybe I didn't have a smartphone when it came out on iOS, but it's just come out on Steam recently. And the Steam version is not dramatically different, I don't think. But there's lots I'm discovering that I've never discovered before, and like most of his games, you never really know, like, if you're playing a later version, you never really know, was this always there? Or have I just unlocked this through something I've done? Because it's seems like a very repetitive roguelike, or very, very small in scope. It's a grid of, like, it seems like only about 16 by 16 tiles or something, and that's a room. And it's randomly populated by just squares that are solid and an empty space. And the squares that are solid, you can kind of plant a kind of bomb next to them, and then when it detonates, it will kind of steal whatever's in that block. So every block will have either some points in it or a special program, and programs are like spells. And so you plant your bomb strategically to try and get as many points as you can, or the programs that you think you'll need to defeat the enemies, which randomly spawn and also spawn in response to you. Stealing those things. Whatever you steal, it has a kind of a cost, and that cost is how many enemies will spawn when you steal it. And it's kind of, it's rogue-like in the in terms of the way time works, in that nothing happens until you move, and when you move, everything moves. And you can't stay still. Like, you can sit there and wait, but time isn't flowing in the game. And so sometimes you get in a situation where, like, you want to stay where you are and have everyone else move, but you can't do that. And so wait is actually a program that you have to get. You have to sort of, like, find it and unlock it. And it's very random. So there are probably, like, 30 different programs you can get, and they're super vital in terms of, like, dealing with enemies. If you don't have any programs at all, it's nigh on impossible. And which ones you get offered, you know, which ones happen to be in the level is random. And so I've had runs where, as I was getting back into it, I started to sort of settle into this pretty good system of, there are four different types of enemies, and one of them's not really a big problem. Each one has, like, a special ability, and the one that isn't a problem to me is the one who's invisible, because they're invisible until they're in your row or your column, and then you can see them. And so you can just kind of maneuver carefully. Once you know one is around, you know, get into a situation where you're in a corridor or something, and then they'll come to you, and you can deal with them. The others are, like, one can move double speed, which is horrible, because it means they move faster than you, so you can't get away from them if they're chasing you. But also, more importantly, if you get enemies into, like, a nice little funnel, and they're all coming one after the other, and you can just kill them all as they come, you can get a situation where this turn there's an enemy in front of you, and you can kill him, but there's a fast enemy behind him, so when you kill him in the same turn, the fast enemy will move into his place and get to attack you before you can do anything about it. And then there's one that can move through walls, and there's one that's extra tough. And those last three each have a kind of anti-program for them. So for the fast one, that's called a virus, and there's literally an antivirus program, and that just hurts all the viruses on them in the whole room. So you could, if there's loads of them, you can just use that twice, and it kills them all. The tough one, you can explode him, so it damages all the enemies near him. And the one that can move through walls, you can kill him if he's currently in a wall. So they're called glitches, and the program that kills them is called debug. So anything that's, like, glitchy gets killed. So my system was, like, buy those three, or get those three as soon as I can, and then I've got, like, an antidote for everything. And the invisible ones I can deal with by myself. And I thought, yes, I figured out this game. But it's very... The thing I love about it, the reason it works so well, is that it's kind of up to you how much challenge you want to take on. If your objective is just to get through those eight levels, that's difficult at first until you really, like, get the hang of the game. But... Actually, no, it's still difficult for me. Thinking about it, I do often die before I get through the eight levels. But if you just try and get to the exit on each level, it's a challenge, and once you've done it, you get a score of zero.
Right.
Because you only get score if you actively go out and get some score. You know, these blocks that have score in them don't do anything except give you score. So if you're just trying to survive, you would never activate one.
Right.
Because they summon enemies. So to get 7 points, you're going to summon seven enemies in this room right now. And usually there are other enemies already around, so sometimes, like, I've set up a bomb that triggered, like, 1 9-point block and 1 7-point block. So it's, like, 16 enemies, and they're already some in the room. It's, like, nearly every cell of this room is now an enemy.
Yeah, the rooms aren't that large, no. So surely that would fill every square on the board.
It gets close, yeah. I mean, right. And then it's got so many little, like, quirks that are really satisfying, really neat, because there's... As well as being antidotes to, like, individual enemies, there's certain things that work well in certain situations. And one is called delay, and it means when an enemy spawns, it's kind of in there. I think of them as eggs. They're just kind of, like, swirly blobs. You can't tell what's going to come out. And next turn, they'll come out. If they never spawn in your direct line of sight, if they can help it. But if you can get to one before it hatches, then you can kill it in one hit. And you can never normally do that because it takes one turn to move, and then they would have hatched by then. But there's one called delay, which just... stops them all from hatching for, like, 3 turns. So while they're all still eggs, you can just kind of mow them down. So, like, if I've got the resources to use that a bunch of times, sometimes I'll just trigger I'll steal all of the most valuable things in the room, like, all at once if I can set up a bomb to do that, and just bring down the wrath of God on me, just fill the entire room with those things, and then just delay, kill 3 things, delay, kill 3 things, delay, kill 3 things. And that's awesome. And also... you're only trying to get to the exit, so even on the last level, you don't have to, like, kill everything like you do in Hoplite. Wait, you don't have to kill everything in Hoplite.
No.
What am I thinking of? Anyway, even on the last level, you just have to leave. So you, on the last level, you always want to steal just everything, because you don't have to deal with the consequences. On every other level, these enemies that you summon, even if you get to the exit, they'll come with you to the next level. And all of the enemies that are on the next level too will be added to that. So you bring in like a little posse of, hi, I brought these guys with me too.
Right.
But on the last level, who cares? Because the game's over. So, you always just steal like all the most valuable things and bring down all the enemies, and then just try and get to the exit. And delay is great for that too, because fill up the room with eggs essentially and then just freeze them and then quickly slip out the exit and leave.
This is great to hear about other builds, because I picked this up last week. I'm playing on an iPad actually, and the phone version, which is the same, I think, as the PC version.
Yeah.
So yeah, after a long day of playing strategy games at ParadoxCon, I'll go back to my room and then play 868 Hat for like 2 hours and then fall asleep, head full of like squares, things attacking each other in them. But yeah, I like to do a really tanky build where I go for reset, which resets your health back to full if you can pay for it, and exchange, which lets you funnel money into energy. These are the two types of resources. When you blow up squares, you get those resources. So I'd summon like 9 or 10 enemies, find like a tight corridor, and then just shoot them all as they came down the corridor. And then after a few hit me, I'd just like reset. And then more would hit me, then I'd go like, okay, energy exchange, reset, and then just kill everything like a giant stupid attack monster. But it's kind of cool that it enables such different playstyles, even on small board.
There's one ability program that's just called Undo, and it only costs $1 to use. But it takes you back to, you know, just takes you back one turn. And so it doesn't help, really, in terms of, like, your situation will be exactly like it was when you last fucked this up, but now you've got $1 less. And it's great because it's, like, it's... When you're thinking about, do I need that? Because, like, every other program, you know, to get it, it's going to cost you something, and it's going to make some enemies show up. So you're thinking, do I need the undo? Am I going to fuck something up? Because any time undo is useful, you literally made an error of judgment. You did something wrong. Like, you shouldn't have done that. So in theory, it's possible to never need undo, because oh, I'll just always do the perfect thing. But I usually get...
It's really surprisingly cute as well, because all the monsters have their own, like, different array of noises, which are kind of riffing on Pac-Man noises. Kind of noises, which is nice. I like that. And also, if you get the kind of the vision program, which lets you see every, like, when the eggs spawn, vision lets you see what they're going to be before they spawn.
And the invisible enemies, you can see them all the time.
They're revealed. And also, like, sometimes some programs are mystery programs, so it reveals those as well. But it also gives you a little smiley face avatar with a third eye.
Yeah.
There's loads of little jokes like that, like, packed just throughout the whole thing.
It's awesome.
It's very cute.
There's also, so this is something I don't know if it was in the build I played before, but now, when you complete, if you get out alive, because it's possible to get loads of points and then just die and still do well in the high score tables because you've got a lot of points. And like I say, like, getting the points is easy. It's dealing with the consequences of it that's difficult. So if you're going to let yourself die, like, if you just get to a level where it has loads and loads of points and you have enough siphon things, bomb things to use to get them, then you could just get them all and let yourself die because you'll still have some points. But the one advantage of getting through alive is that the next time you play, it's counted as sort of continuing, and you lose all your abilities and stuff. You're still, like, technically a new avatar, but your score for this run will be added to the score from the last run in a different high score table. So that's called, like, the streak high scores. And it's just how many times you've successively completed the game. But, like, the first time you loop... First time you get through it and then start a new game, you get like a bonus. You unlock something for having completed it, and you get like a new ability will become available. And in addition to being seeded throughout the game as a thing you pick up, for that life, you get given it for free, right at the start. Huh. So the last one I got was like fucking blew my mind because it was Attack Plus, and it's an ability that costs loads of energy and money to use. But it upgrades your basic attack to do 2 damage instead of 1 for the rest of that room, which is nuts because everything only has 2 health, so you're just like, well, now just kill everything in one hit. You just become like a super thing. And so that's great. And then I've just started to get to the point where I can loop, like, twice, so I have a third run through. And after you complete your second run through, the first time I did it, it said, bonus power unlocked. Rear-mounted laser. I'm like, oh, brilliant, because when you move towards stuff, you laser it. And I thought, great, now it's going to laser out the back as well. I'll kill 2 things at once. And I'm starting to realize Microbros power up unlocked message is slightly ironic, because what he really means is it only comes out the back now. So I can't attack anything I'm moving towards.
Amazing.
And worse, that's not really the disadvantage. The disadvantage is that I can't run away from anything ever. If it's behind me, if I want to move away from it, I automatically attack it instead of moving.
Okay.
So, it's kind of, that's just awkward, and I got used to it, and I made a few mistakes because I forgot that I had it, but eventually I got used to it. The next time I looped twice, the bonus power up was, the invisible enemies can now teleport while invisible. So there's just no knowing where they are. They just could be absolutely anywhere, absolutely any time. And that's, I don't know, a lot of times it's like something new has happened that's been difficult to deal with, and I'm like, oh, this is bullshit, I don't like this. And then eventually I get used to it and think, no, actually, that's really good, because you, like, it's cool for this reason. Currently, the teleporting invisible ones, I'm having a hard time seeing the upside of that. That seems like just randomly they'll just take a health point off you. Just there's no way to know that was going to happen. If you got that third eye thing, then great. But I was looking out for that, and it didn't come up on any of the levels that I got to. I just got killed by constantly taking damage from invisible teleporting enemies.
I like the idea that kind of achievement unlocked milestones can be used to tone difficulty. So you're clearly very experienced if you've got to that level. So in order to keep the game interesting for you, it introduces this dangerous new element that you now have to deal with.
Yeah.
It's quite clever, actually. I'm not quite think of many of the games that really do that.
There's so many little elegant things like that. Like, there's an ability called Score.
Oh, yeah.
And all it does is it costs like 5 energy to use, and it just gives you some points. But the twist is it gives you the number of points equivalent to the number of levels left in the current run. So, because when I first got it, I was like, oh, it gives me score for energy. Great, I'll just play the game normally, and then when I get to the last level, whatever energy I've got, I'll spend it all on the score thing. And it wouldn't let me use it at all, because on level 8, there are 0 levels left to go, so it gets you 0 points.
It's expensive as well.
If you use it on level 1, you get 7 points for every time you use it. So, but of course, on level 1, you don't have a reserve of energy built up yet, so it's like, if you see it on level 1, you grab it, and then use all of the rest of the other siphon you get to get as many energy points as possible, then you use it on that level. And then as you go throughout the game, you're always like, it's always encouraging you to blow all of your resources really, really early and leave yourself with nothing for the next level. And of course, the game's getting harder as well, and you're unlocking more and more programs that are useful and sometimes essential to get by, and they all consume these resources. So as you need more resources, you're being more and more encouraged to get rid of them. And it gets to the point where, like, it's so satisfying to do it when it works, because it's just like, 3 points! Like, no more enemies came. I just used this thing. I just, like, made this deal with the devil and got some 3 points. And when you're getting 7 points for it, that's great. And when it goes down to, like, 4, it's like, oh, it's still just about worth it. And then you're getting, like, 3. It's like, am I just pouring my resources into a hole? Is this why I'm so fucked? Because I spent all my fucking money on this. But it's always, like, everything in it, it's, like, testing you to bet on yourself. It's saying, like, I'm sure you're good enough to do this. Like, if you're willing to just take a little bit of a risk, you can have all these points and you'll do better and better. Yeah, stuff that, like, self-balances like that is really appealing to me at the moment. That's actually, I mean, I'm coming off at it fresh off Invisible Ink, and they're really similar, actually, for all the visual differences. Invisible Ink is beautiful, and this is frankly very ugly.
No, it's the perfect aesthetic for the game, I think you'll find, Tom.
I think I like its aesthetic more than some of his other games. There are others where, like, I just sort of can't even see what's going on. It might just be that I'm really used to this one because I played it for a long time, but it's very low res. The thing I can't cope with is the music.
Oh, God.
Which is sort of discordant, atonal, like, it sounds like music, but it's been put through something, and that came out wrong, which I'm sure is intentional. It's all about glitches and things going badly wrong. And it's, like you say, the sound effects are like Pac-Man, but sort of gone bad. But because I play it for a long time, I get sick of the music. So I've hacked my version appropriately enough, because there's no option to turn it off. So I think with the version I had before, I could just, like, delete the music files. But then in this version, it crashes if the music files aren't there. And there's, like, 12 of them. So I've had to find a silent OGG file and go through it, copy it 12 times, and rename it to all of the 12 files, just so it won't play any fucking music. So that I can listen to my own. It's an interesting ambience if it doesn't have any music, because there's still sound effects, and there's kind of, like, there's some noises just kind of going on in the background anyway, and every sound effect seems to me... The thing is, with Michael Bros games, you never tell whether something's a bug or an aesthetic decision, but the sounds get worse as you play. Like, the further towards the end of the run you get, the more distorted they become, and the more it sounds like... I thought it was, like, wrong with my speakers at first, because, like, a sound effect would just be really crackly and scrapey and also like last for twice as long as it should.
Mm.
And so I don't know for sure that isn't a bug, but it's certainly a interesting aesthetic.
Do you think you should make prettier games? Where do you fall on that? Because there are, the reason I said earlier that it's the perfect aesthetic for it is that there are defenders of Michael Brew's aesthetic who say that it is ugly for a reason. It must be ugly. You can't make a more pretty game and still to mean the same thing as a
Michael Brew
game, which I think is probably shit.
I quite like 868 Hacks aesthetic, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, there are things I'd definitely fix, like the dark... so the name of each program is in dark purple against black, and that's just bad. Like, you have to be able to read what it is. I mean, if you know. But apart from that, I think the idea of being this crackly, shitty mainframe is exactly what the setting is, isn't it?
Yeah, it sort of suits it.
And also, we've seen loads of super slick depictions of cyberspace. I quite like one that's fragmented and a bit fucked up.
In general, though, is the question, like, I do find some of the other games off-puttingly ugly, or just, like, not to my taste. And the question of, like, should he, you know, use a different artist or change his own art style or something is, like, if he's happy doing it that way, then fine. He shouldn't be forced to or anything.
No, of course
but
not.
But he certainly... I feel like his games are... 868 is, like, really brilliant and actually very accessible. Yeah, it's got a really good tutorial now.
Oh, right.
It's quite simple. All the, like, the
I really kind of stopped it when I first played it, because your explanation there just made clear a lot of things that were definitely not clear to me when I played it.
There is a good tutorial now.
Yeah.
It gives you, like, portions of the board, and then you fight from one portion to the next, and it explains.
And, yeah, apparently, he's done a blog post about releasing it on PC, because it's apparently been 2 years, and... if I remember right, he hasn't done much in that time, like according to his post. And he said it's just been really dispiriting because he's got lots of iOS games out now. And every time they update iOS, he has to patch them all because it breaks them all. Oh, and every time they release a new phone, he's got to support new resolutions and stuff. And he just, as I would, hates it. And says it just kind of drains his energy to make new things. And he just feels like, you know, making another new thing would just be another fucking thing he's got to maintain all the time. Which rather begs the question why he didn't just put them on Steam in the first place. Mm. Maybe, I suppose, like, Greenlight has been pretty harsh on stuff that doesn't, you know, look gorgeous. But it's like, so 868 is massively well respected in the sort of game, particularly the game development community, and I think among journalists as well.
Yeah, that's great.
And Corrupt, which I haven't, that's a game that initially seems about pushing blocks around and has this annoying thing, I find it annoying, that the blocks you push around stick to you, so you can't drop them. Mm. You have to kind of scrape them off yourself. And I found that very irritating. I didn't really like block pushing puzzles inherently anyway. Like, I like them if they're amazing and blow my mind, but this one wasn't doing it for me.
Later.
And so I keep hearing that there's a moment at which it fundamentally changes, but I couldn't get that far. I was just stuck on basic blocks shoveling stuff. But that is also, like, widely regarded as one of the greatest puzzle games ever made, and, like, revelatory. So it is weird, or something slightly wrong with the picture that he's, like, sort of scraping by, I think. I mean, I don't know what his actual personal finances are like, but in the blog post he says that they're selling some copies, but not many.
Yeah, you'd think 868 Hack would have enough momentum behind it to do pretty well. But. Shame if it isn't.
And yeah, that's the one where, you know, its art style is kind of okay. Like, probably the one least in need of, or least suffering from its art style, at least. Commercially.
Marsh.
Uh-huh.
What have you been playing? Sorry to ask you in the middle of a...
This week. Yeah, I've been playing lots of things, actually, since I last was on the podcast. I want to talk about Life is Strange, but I can't talk about it for long, because I've completely erased nearly everything I thought about it 3 weeks ago when I played it. It's a sort of Telltale-ish sort of game set in a school. I don't really understand the American system of schooling, but it seems to be for people who are 18 and yet very kind of, doesn't feel like a university sort of scenario. Maybe it does. I don't really understand. But anyway.
High school?
I don't know, but she's the character that you play into is studying photography, like, exclusively.
Oh,
hang on, maybe she does study science as well. Oh God, I don't even know. But anyway, it's set in this this school, and the kind of principal hook of it is that you suddenly discover that you have time control powers, and you are thrust very forward into the future where you see a glimpse of some terrible calamity befalling the town, and then you suddenly return to lessons, and then you kind of try and find some resolution for that, and then you realise that you can deal with certain social problems by reversing them, and but it proceeds in the sort of way that a kind of a Telltale game might, that you have conversations that you navigate in social situations that you can choose between, and these sort of things. But one of the it's kind of a nice setting. I mean, somebody said it was, I think it's on one of their promotional posters, but it's Gone Home meets Twin Peaks. And that is a pretty good kind of, hybrid to describe it.
Hmm.
And it's kind of nice. It's a bit kind of cloying in how laser focused its attempt to nail that aesthetic is. Like, there's this kind of twangly, kind of inoffensive guitar pop that the girl likes to listen to, which is quite possibly the kind of thing that American girls of the age of 18 like to listen to, but it's obviously awful. All the fonts are that hand-drawn indie font.
Isn't it everything that you can interact with kind of outlined in a squiggly, a cute kind of squiggly animated?
Yeah.
Which is Sabrina the Teenage Witch, right? I mean, that's the aesthetic they've accidentally stumbled on there.
Yeah, totally. But it's also quite charming. We were talking just before the podcast started that apparently some people have really gone against the writing, and I thought the writing was fairly inoffensive to good, somewhere between those points. There were some clankers. I can't remember what they were now. And there's some really bad actors in it.
Mm.
But on the whole, it seems pretty good. But the thing that I like about it, in comparison with the Telltale game, so like to Telltale games, to take the recent Game of Thrones game. The reason I really dislike that is that Telltale games, the choices in it are so prescriptive and contrived, and there's a sense of enforced parallelism in the way that reality unfolds. So you can choose choice A, and you get choice A1, choice A2, choice A3, or you can choose choice B, and you get choice B1, which B2, and B3. And they're an exact kind of mirror of each other. And, like, that's so offensive for somebody trying to offensive is a bit strong. It's so wrong for the world of Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones is about chaos and just events rolling on and emergency and all these things that can't be predicted. But if you could, the choices that you'd make would be very asymmetrical. And actually, what this does, somebody's played like Telltale games and they've played Heavy Rain, and they've gone, why do we make these kind of mirror decisions? Wouldn't it be so much fun if you could just instantly replay the decision you made and saw what else would happen?
Right.
And actually that has an effect of kind of resolving a lot of the contrivances that are inherent in that genre, because you can suddenly, you can play something through, and then just for laughs, you can see what happens when you make fun of the posh girl in the school for getting paint on her. And then you can choose to follow the kind of the better part of your nature and do the right thing.
Right.
And actually that does have, unlike, I mean, some of it, there are still kind of, messages on the screen, like, the kind of Telltale, they'll remember this kind of thing, or this will have repercussions later kind of messages. But most of the time, judging by the percentage, this is what other people did making these decisions that you get shown at the end. You get a kind of screen at the end which tells you how other people did their decisions. Most people did the same thing. Eventually.
Steve Gaynash showed a screenshot of his summary on that, and one of his decisions only 1% of players did.
Wow.
Which was blame something on Ramona. I don't know what that means.
Ah, I don't remember that either.
But it sounded like, I can only imagine that in context it must be a wildly unreasonable thing to do.
Yeah, but I quite like that, because it actually means that, I mean, because I believe that there is, like, morality in the universe, and I think there are better decisions than others, and games that don't reinforce that message reinforce something very strange and corrosive, I think. And actually, when you have a game like this that allows you to kind of exert your id and then choose to do the right thing, I think that's a really good, I think that's just something really pleasing about that.
My two main motivators for making a decision in a game are A, see what happens.
Yeah.
Or B, I'm pretty sure from the way this is set up, I'm going to be rewarded for doing this. This just seems like that. Like, this is the virtuous option. They always not only thank you for doing virtuous option, but also materially reward you more in video games. That's just become a universal thing now. You always just get more profit for doing the right thing. Therefore, I'm motivated, even bribed, to do the right thing, which completely ruins the element of choice.
There's an element, especially in adventure games, where they can't punish you. There's no way to punish the player for making a poor decision. Because there's no health bar, there's no inventory or kind of way to stop your progress or impinge you in any way. So there is no sense that everything you do is equal. No, you'll progress at exactly the same rate, no matter whether you slay everyone or give everyone sweets. You know, like, there's no way for them to gate you. This is a chronic problem with the adventure game morality thing, unfortunately. But it sounds, this kind of fudgy way of doing it sounds like a...
Yeah, you couldn't do that in every game.
No.
Yeah, suddenly everybody's in Game of Thrones has got time reverse powers.
Thrones are strange.
But there's... I mean, I'm not... I don't want to sing the game's praises too much. I did quite like it and found it quite charming, but there's some bullshit in it where your time reverse powers are just not available for you to use during certain key decisions.
I can see how it would undermine, like... a lot of dramatic tension if you can just always rewind. And...
Yeah, this dickhead comes up and beats up your friend and you're just like, I'm going to get in a car and drive off. Like, well, what? I just reverse that fight until I hit the shit out of him, you know? Anyway.
Remember Heroes where one of the characters can reverse time in Heroes and then they just sort of like 90% of the time just have to forget he has it because otherwise all drama is dead.
Yeah.
I've got to say, the high school setting, I'm quite torn by it, because I hate everything, all television and films set in high schools, I invariably hate them, because all the characters' problems I don't care about, and think they should probably stop stressing about their stupid problems.
Yeah.
But in video games, I find it fascinating. I love the high school
really?
Setting. Yeah, I love Persona, like Persona 4, for example. I love the kind of doing the gossip in the day and then fighting the demons at night and then go back in the day.
That's
and go,
not what most high school is like, I think.
Maybe it's because they make high school fun. And but I don't know. I find the mundane novel in video games in a way that I despise in other mediums.
Oh, I don't mind that it's mundane. I think I don't even dislike it particularly, but I don't find that I really understand or empathise deeply with the kinds of social cliquery that goes on and seems to be the kind of the principal problem that assails the lives of 18-year-olds in American dramas.
I don't know if it's like... Maybe American schools are really like that, and they're all based on that. Or maybe it's the fact that they're fictional that makes them all really similar, and also very unrelatable.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is actually it's a really beautiful looking... It's very nicely made, but they've made some really weird choices. Like, there seems to be... Some of it is photoreal in the way that the Unreal Engine is definitely trying to go towards. You know, I mean,
it's not quite pads and
But you know, the Unreal Engine can put out some pretty impressive looking stuff, and it's obviously going towards that. But then you get close to certain kind of textures, like anything like a poster, and it's obviously been just kind of speed painted or scribbled. But I mean, that's part of it. It's like kind of like things at distance look kind of like any other Unreal Engine game, almost photoreal. Then you go close to it, and all the textures are these kind of hand-drawn stuff, which fits with the kind of Sabrina the Witch aesthetic. And it's kind of strange. Something really annoyed me. It has a cloud of starlings swirling around, but it's a particle effect. So the starlings just... Eventually, the kind of particles just die, and so the starlings get to the edge of the cloud, and they just disappear. You're like, that's not fooling anybody. The other game I wanted to talk about is Grow Home.
Ah, Ubisoft.
It's by Reflections, who I think are the studio up north, aren't they?
Why are they here in the?
Aren't they the people who made Driver San Francisco? I should probably have looked at this before.
That's a switch of tone.
But I mean, they're an interesting studio, I think. And
isn't Driver San Francisco the one where you can possess other drivers.
Yes,
it is. I really want to play this.
Oh, it is fantastic.
You're in a coma.
It is the best game about a coma yet. This is not.
There are a lot of games about comas. There really are lots of indie.
Yeah,
yeah. It's very. It's kind of like Quantum Leap.
There's one called Coma.
Very much.
Yeah.
But yeah, Driver San Francisco is really nice. It's just kind of, it's got this kind of chirpy Sunday morning TV serial kind of writing to it. It's quite funny and weird, and the whole kind of just repossessing different vehicles across the city is just immense fun.
Great.
They should have called it Repo Man.
oh my God. but now they've made Grow Home, which is, a game in which you play a robot who has to climb up a series of floating islands, and it's just there's not really much more to it than that.
Is it like a linear single player thing? Like, it was all pre-made.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it has a kind of lo-fi polygonal look that you kind of associate with procedurally generated things. I don't think it is procedurally generated, or at least, I mean. If it is procedure generated the exact same way for everybody who plays it, as far as I know. But I'm sure again, like this group of people have looked at, Starseed Pilgrim and thought, well, we can make something a bit like that, but maybe less obtuse. And so you're this little robot, called Bud, and the computer that you, or the mothership is called Mom, which is quite cute. And, whenever a message comes in, he gets, Mom! but everything about it is kind of just teetering on the saccharine, but really, really endearing. And it's kind of just gorgeously lit. And,
apparently they were inspired by WALL-E.
Oh, yeah.
Which now makes sense.
Yeah, that does. Actually, all the kind of, what you were saying about all the interesting kind of Pac-Man-y noises, like he's making all the kinds of noises of dot matrix printers and things like that.
Yes.
And there's an era of sound that is not around anymore, but it's very nostalgic for me.
Nostalgic power for it, yeah.
But, the way you kind of navigate these floating, islands is that you have to grow a star plant, and you do that by, climbing up it, and you has this kind of quop. I mean, you have to use a gamepad for it, and you can use alternate triggers to kind of and one of the analog sticks to kind of direct your hands and then anchor them.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels really good to do that. The kind of the way that the procedural animation system makes sense of your body after that doesn't really work, so you kind of just spaz out on the rock. But I mean, it feels nonetheless very satisfying to do, and there's an amazing sense of vertigo when you're kind of just climbing up this kind of overhang, and you look down, and I can feel my balls just trying to shrink back into my body.
Do you die if you fall?
You, from a certain height, yes, but eventually you begin to, you collect more gems, which are kind of locked in the landscape. You actually yank them out of the rock using this kind of anchoring system, which is very satisfying. And then you get certain power-ups that allow you to kind of better navigate or mitigate the damage from falls. But you just respawn if you break yourself. But you climb up this plant, and then there's kind of spurs from it that you grab hold of, and then you can press X, and they suddenly start growing, and you can kind of ride them like a it's a bit phallic, really, but you know, like the bomb out of
Strangelove, Doctor Strangelove.
Yes, Doctor Strangelove.
Just kind of mount it,
and then direct them into some of the floating islands, which have these kind of green oozy bases, which is obviously some kind of fertilizer for the overall plant. And once you do that, the plant kind of grows even further, and then more spurs emerge from it, and so you kind of slowly kind of make your way up through the sky, and it's a really pleasant experience. We often get questions about what games are good for children on the podcast. Mm. And that's, I think it's not so challenging that it would, beat a 7-year-old, but it's also, interesting and enjoyable enough that I'm my simple mind is entertained.
Yeah, it sounds weird. Yeah. Wait, are you like, when you're riding those plant stem things, are you freely steering it?
Yeah, there's a bit of resistance to it, and occasionally they kind of veer off, but yeah.
You can, so you're kind of making your own.
Yeah.
Vines or like the sort of
chaotic. Absolutely. There's a limit to the amount that they can grow, so sometimes in order to reach a certain floating island, you need to plan a bit before you can fire one off. But yeah,
that sounds cool.
It's really nice, very satisfying game. Good chill out game.
GURP meets Starseed Pilgrim.
Yes,
that's how I should pitch it to the 25 people in the world who know both the games.
Tom. have you been playing?
I've been playing Total War Attila. Which is kind of a standalone expansion to Rome 2, or a sequel, I guess, of sorts, which is set during very beginning of the Dark Ages, when the Roman Empire was in collapse and barbarians were nicking their biscuits, quite literally raiding them from every angle. The Roman Empire is divided into Western and Eastern factions, and in this period of also this climate change rushing in from the north and freezing everyone, and you get to take charge of any of the factions involved in this terrible time and try and basically survive in a horrible brown world that is descending into darkness, which is kind of great for a Total War game. The game is all about war and pillaging and burning, and it's especially fun to play as the Huns, who are obviously named after Attila. And he's like, you start before he's born, and his birth, among other things, are apocalyptic sigils that echo across the land. So whatever faction you play as, you'll get a massive bonging message saying, Attila is born in the east. he is coming, kind of thing. And because the Romans, who were Catholics at the time, they thought the apocalypse was actually happening. There was kind of apocalyptic sense because they were being attacked from every angle. And if you play as the Western Roman Empire, it's basically the hardest position to play as in the game. Like, you're giving a little difficulty rating at the start when you choose to begin a campaign. And that difficulty is, like, legendary because they were just torn apart very, like, gradually over the course of decades by just relentless barbarian attack. And of course, because much of the Gothic hordes didn't have written language, the reason why we call it the Dark Ages is because there is no history beyond that point because no one wrote anything down. So there is this kind of feeling of inky blackness kind of coming down over the world, and that's reflected visually in the kind of this Instagram filter that seems to have been applied to a Total War, where everything is slightly brown and sepia, and almost all the skies are overcast in battles, and even when they're not, there's this kind of hazy darkness, dark red skies to them.
And then the Dark Ages gave way to the hashtag no filter ages. Nor as well.
It's a stark contrast to Rome 2, which is absolutely beautiful, beautifully colourful, like beautiful sunshine. When you the post processing changes depending on where you pan over in the map in Rome 2. So if you go over into the Mediterranean, suddenly you get this kind of wonderful warm heat, and all the textures are different and sandy and beautiful. And then you go off into Scotland, and everything is cold and looks like Saving Private Ryan. That kind of filter where, like, the sharpness filter comes in. Whereas, they're so good at committing to creating a mood, in a grand strategy game, which is really, like, no other company really devotes resources to doing that in the same way as the Creative Assembly, to creating this kind of aesthetically contiguous thing that gives you a real sense of being in that time, as historians have seen it. As a strategy game, it's pretty good, though it is based on Rome 2's kind of design. And therefore suffers from the same problems. The same systems that were malfunctioning in Rome 2 are still problematic in Attila, especially the politics system, which I just don't... I've played so much Rome 2 now and a lot of Attila, I just don't understand what I'm supposed to do with it and what it's for. You can see your family tree, and you've got your system of government, and there's a bar that tells you how much control you have over your faction, your state or whatever. And you can promote family members into positions of power, and that will increase your control over your faction. But the more you increase your control, the more you're punished by various kind of negative, kind of, you get stat debuffs to your civilization for becoming too powerful. And when I'm the Huns, if I become a warlord, don't I want to just be the most powerful, unchallenged warlord I can be in order to run this faction most effectively? It doesn't really make any sense to me. I can't think what you're supposed to do. Because if you promote your guys, they become more influential. If they become too influential, then you start getting debuffs. So you can assassinate your own people. why would I do that? And some of them are generals, of course. Like in the Roman Senate, generals and politicians have political roles. So your best generals are out there, and they're, like, really powerful in the Senate. And if they're, like, I'm not going to kill them off if he's the leader of my biggest army. And like, I don't understand what the system is for or what it wants me to do. It just seems to be arbitrarily fucking with me for no apparent reason. So the only solution is to leave it completely alone. And that's an entire strata of just, you know, that should be important and it should be kind of necessary to running your empire or whatever. And though it still has those problems, and that's just because of the way that entire system is designed from the ground up for Rome too. Which they haven't redesigned it because it's kind of built so deep in those systems now that they just can't kind of drag it out and untangle it. However, the stuff they've done with the factions outside of the politics system is great. So the Huns, they don't have towns in the traditional sense that you upgrade in order to build new people. They're completely roaming clans, and your armies, at a click of a button, can become a settlement anywhere. In the enemy territory, just so you can go right up to Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire, probably one of the most powerful factions on the board. You can just camp outside Constantinople. And if they can't move you, you're still staying there, eating their food, raiding their villages, taking their shit. And, their rule set is fantastic because it really encourages you to be incredibly aggressive and to just burn. Just move and burn and move on burn. And, then raise another army and then move that army, north to burn the north while, you know, you go, east to the Sassanids and burn them. And it's very hard to begin with because you only have like two or three armies to use. But the sense of momentum that you get by playing as the Huns is, both immense and very reflective of their astonishing impact on that historical period. Through mechanics, they've realised the terrifying force, and it's really satisfying and fun to embody that, especially when you start going up against the Romans, because they have these very well-drilled, tight blocks of infantry. And of course, the Huns have just these magnificent cavalry units, these astonishing horse archers who are incredibly quick and can just run out of a forest, fire arrows, then just be gone. And, you know, just fighting the Romans as that army when you're more powerful than them and you've got more resources is just so satisfying. And it's just fun to fuck up the Romans, basically. And in that way, it is kind of brilliant.
So it sounds like it covers the same period as At the Gates, the thing John Schaefer is making.
Oh, yeah.
The Civ 5 designer. Because that's also fall of the Roman Empire at the hands of the barbarians. And that you are barbarians, whether you like it or not, you're just like a tribe of barbarians. And it's got a kind of like, the Romans are like an NPC faction, and they're massively more powerful than you at the start. But then the longer the game goes on, the more they are whittled down by all these barbarian factions at their gates. And there's a kind of tipping point, and it's meant to kind of incentivize all of you, all of the rival barbarian factions to kind of, the one who conquers the Roman Empire is going to obviously be in a pretty good position, but the one who attacks the Roman Empire too soon before they're weak enough is going to be annihilated. Yes. So you're always like, I want to invade Rome.
Attila's great for that because there's actually an objective as the Huns to, a bonus objective, an optional one, where you can ally with the Western Roman Empire. And says, oh, if you form an alliance with them, you'll get 2,000 gold. And it's actually a really good thing to do because they're very rich. They've got loads of money. So if you actually and also historically, they sometimes did hire Huns to help defend them. So there's a whole different approach you could take to that historical period where the Huns side with the Romans and kill all the other barbarians and the Sassanids. And in that sense, they've actually resolved one of the core problems with the Total War format, which there's always this anxiety between the sandbox element of Total War and the historical element, you know, how, to what extent do you follow what actually happened, to what extent do you restrict the player from doing anything too insane. And because the storyline is this kind of series of apocalyptic portents that's almost outside of your activity, they've actually maintained a sense that you're acting out that period, but also giving you the freedom to just do completely different things if you really want to, which is really successful. So yeah, it's good. The only thing I'd say is I'm not sure why you'd pay £30 for it if you have Rome 2. And Rome 2 just feels like a richer and bigger, more beautiful and sunny and, exciting thing to me than Attila.
Oh, really?
So it's almost, especially because they released the Emperor Edition, which is basically the totally fixed version of it, where they've got rid of loads of the bugs and given it a graphical update, and it runs a lot better. And that was released only about, 5 or 6 months ago. So I honestly, if you came up to me, I'd say just buy that instead of Attila. which is a shame. So they're almost cursed by the proximity to their own release.
The other thing sounds good to me because I've been listening to the Hardcore History podcast, and someone had recommended just that podcast in general, and I was looking through its recent episodes and figuring out what thing I should listen to get into it. And he'd just done this guy called Dan Carlin, and he just basically talks you through a period of history, but he's an amazing storyteller.
Okay.
And he'd just done like a 5-part series called The Wrath of Khans, and it's the story of Genghis Khan and the Mongols. And that's a fucking amazing story. And sounds like the same dichotomy them and their enemies that Attila and the Romans had, where, like, dudes on horses, pretty fucking good. And the Mongols were not only fucking amazing on horses, they're, like, you know, expert archers and expert horsemen and also expert horsemen archers, and would do things like time their arrow shots for the moment in the horse's gait when all of his feet are off the ground so that they're not being jogged by it.
And still shoot birds out of the air in flight.
Yes. And because they lived on, like, just plains with no kind of farmable land, they just ate horses. So their army was dudes on horses, but each man had like 5 horses because the horses were also what they were eating, and they would, you know, when they were tired out, they'd switch in new horses and stuff. So they were like, you know, only a fifth of the army was humans. Mostly horse faction.
That's a brilliant game, like, resource for a game mechanic, isn't it? That the thing that makes you militarily powerful is also the thing that keeps you alive in these
places. Yeah, it just meant they had no supply lines, so they couldn't cut them off because they were just self-sufficient, basically.
Yeah.
Which is why they pillaged and destroyed everything around them.
And the thing that, like, all their supplies were moving with them, and they were moving at the speed of horse, which at that period and for 1,000 years before and 1,000 years after was the fastest thing in the universe. Yeah. Nothing can move faster than a horse.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I always like the Total War games for that thing you mentioned about being able to kind of depart from history and do the kind of what-ifs. And having listened now for about, I don't know, 8 hours of Dan Carlin talking at me about Mongols, I really want to hear the what-ifs, because, like, there's just so many pivotal things that would completely change the globe entirely. Like, they killed between something like 20 and 80 million people. And, you know, they wiped out pretty much Russia. They pushed all the way into France on one of their expeditions. And the only reason that they didn't conquer in the entire of Europe to the Atlantic and possibly Britain as well is because some guy feigned having gout.
Really?
Yeah, there was like a succession squabble.
It's because Genghis Khan died and he'd set it up really well for his sons to take over. He was like one of the few rulers who made sure that when he was dead, everyone knew who his successor would be. It wouldn't be decided by birthright or anything. He'd decide logically who was the best man for the job and have all of his sons agree. Like, they're all on board. Like, yep, that son should be the one to rule.
Right.
And so when he did, they were okay with it. But then it was when he died, wasn't it?
I think
the son died not that long after because he was a massive drinker. Mm. And then when they were trying to decide how to replace him, one of the guys, the likely candidate to replace him, was a rival of one of the other people who had to be there at the meeting. They have to have a big meeting to decide. And so that guy just called in sick to the meeting for like 5 years.
And this prevented them from...
And so the whole empire was just completely paralysed. They couldn't conquer Europe. They just collapsed.
Normally, don't empires resolve this by just killing, like... There's another group who just comes in and kills the indecisive ones and takes over.
Yeah.
They were sort of weirdly, like utterly ruthless to their enemies, but sort of weirdly democratic in some ways, almost. Mm. Like, they were just very logical, and the key families seemed to be just have unassailable respect. So even when this guy was clearly fucking them around, you know, they were probably going to kill him if he showed up. They weren't going to hold the meeting without him. Which is
why he didn't want to show up. After a while, he was like, I don't think I'm going to be the flavour of the month.
It would be really interesting. I haven't played the Total War games. So I don't know how much this plays into it. But one of the key factors in what determines who wins those fights is information. Because one of the biggest differences between war then and war now is that nobody fucking knows anything.
Mm.
Like, you know, most people died to the Mongols because they didn't believe the Mongols were very powerful. Even though after they killed the first 80 million people, like, Russian cities were like, I'm sure we could take them. We've fought people on horses before, it'll be fine. And they just get utterly killed. And then the Mongols, you know, killed every last person. So the next town didn't hear about it. Oh, horsemen, I think we'd take them. But also, like, even on the battlefield, if people start to panic, I mean, that is, I know, in a big factor in Total War.
Yeah.
They couldn't sort of coordinate. You know, if it seemed like some of your friends are running, you just kind of run as well. Yeah. Whereas the Mongols, if you ran and the rest of your unit of 10 didn't, they killed you on the spot. And if your unit of 10 ran, but the rest of your unit of 100 didn't, then the unit of 100 killed all of your people. And so they were just like, they had to all do the same thing all at once. And so they were like one of the only disciplined factions who were actually, you know, all doing the same thing at the same time. At least according to this podcast, which I'm taking as total gospel from any sources.
Yeah, there's other stuff about kind of the significance of them in that they would, after they'd sallied into Europe and basically duffed up Russia and killed and burnt, but then retreated to their homelands, then they decimated the Islamic world completely and also destroyed China. and Dan Carlin makes the case that if they had turned their attention to Europe, or if they hadn't, in fact, that they left a power vacuum, essentially, that the Europe was then able to fill.
Mm.
And if the Islamic world and China hadn't been so destroyed, then Europe would have remained the third best power in the world for a long time. And it was possibly only because China and the Islamic world are taken out of the picture by the Mongols.
We rose to prominence.
Yeah, that we could seek the new world and all this other stuff, you know. And, yeah.
That's why games about history are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And there should be more of them.
Should we do questions from questions?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Dear CNC, writes Rob. First off, just want to say that I'm so jazzed to have a PC-focused podcast. Perhaps there are others.
No, I don't think so.
No. But yours is totes faves.
Awesome.
Also, you guys have top-notch show notes. Quite right. I enjoy starting my weekend with some insightful game criticism and some random silliness. Now, I appreciate a healthy dose of randomness in my podcasts, but when it comes to my games, I'm considering a zero-tolerance policy. Recently, I've been playing through Wasteland 2, and every time I try to go through a box, safe, minefield, or brick wall, I face a random number generator, which will grant me success as long as I'm persistent and reload enough times. Maybe I'm doing it wrong, but given the slightest chance, I will run repeated trials until I get what I want. But I'm not happy about it. There's a lot of randomness in this game. Random encounters in the waste, weapon damage, hit, chance, crit, chance, loot. However, some skill checks are fixed, such as dialogue options granted by skills. Why can't other skills operate on this level? Why do developers use random chance as a mechanic? Perhaps the problem is that the game tells me what the chances are. I mean, aren't computer games great because they do all the math under the hood and you don't have to roll a damn die? Thanks, Rob. In pre-Wasteland Los Angeles. And he says, P.S., I should probably say I'm enjoying Wasteland 2 very much.
I think it's because if you have hard and fast rules, like if you have the skill then it always works, or if you try this then it will never work, then either things become trivial or the player can get totally stuck and there's literally no way for them to get past it. Whereas if it's a random chance, then even if it fucks you and actually ends your whole playthrough, you're still like, well, it could have gone right. You know, the game didn't totally block me off from any chance of success. And I also think it's kind of like, it's got an inherent drama to it, like things can go wrong and right. And when it does tell you the percentage chance, that tells you something about what happened. Like, you know, if you have like a 15% chance to make a shot in XCOM and it works, yeah, you're like, fucking yes!
I don't think
Whereas if it didn't tell you that chance, it would just be like, okay.
The thing he says about, I have not played Wasteland 2, but if you can just do the same thing again and again until you succeed, that seems to kind of be pointless.
Yeah, yeah. That isn't, I don't know if he's talking about, is he, like, reloading, or...?
Well, I'm assuming what he's talking about there is trying to open a box, or a safe, or do something with a minefield, or a brick wall.
And the way it works in, like, if you don't want to play the minigame in Oblivion, you can, like, do a...
Oh, yeah.
An automated attempt, and it's got a random chance, but each time you fail, you're using a lockpick. I don't know if Wasteland or something like that, but if you literally use nothing, and you can just keep clicking try again until it works, then that's dumb.
A lot of random chances used to communicate how many skills you like your effectiveness at something. So you control the percentage roll by investing in skills in RPGs to reduce or increase the likelihood of a thing happening. But it's really like there's such a fine line between that feeling satisfying, and I think it almost never is, because like the percentage chance, like taking a skill to increase my crit chance by 2% is just meaningless in terms of decision to, you know, response in Diablo or in something else. And so many choices in RPGs, so many choices in percentage chance systems are about these tiny tweaks to percentages that you can never really see.
Yeah, you'll never spot it. Mm. In fact, like, even something that takes you from, like, you know, 10% to 30% chance or something, you would actually need to do it thousands of times before you can conclusively conclude the difference that had been made.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think XCOM uses it brilliantly because it's introduces enough room for surprise or for unexpected circumstance that you have to adapt to. So if the guy who has like a 75% chance of blowing a guy's head off doesn't that round, and he kills one of your teammates, the enemy kills one of your teammates as a result, that's suddenly like a thing you have to deal with that could have happened. Like, it feels reasonable. It also exposes just enough of the system to let you kind of make the decision and know that you're kind of how much control you
have. I know it should feel reasonable, but I feel so aggrieved when I miss an 80% chance to hit shot.
Have you ever missed a 99?
No, I don't think so.
I've missed a 99. Been there.
You're a special snowflake.
There's something about, like, in XCOM, it's exciting to roll dice, basically, I think, as well. I think taking chances when it's just an all-or-nothing chance, like shooting someone, there's an element of excitement around that. There's an element of anticipation to watching the animation wind up and seeing what's going to happen. I think XCOM exploits that brilliantly.
Yeah. I was thinking about chance recently when I was playing 868 Hack, because it's, like, lots of things are random in it, but mostly it feels like a sort of very, like, strict puzzle game. Like, you know, there's very hard and fast rules about if you know where all the enemies are, then you know for sure what the outcome of your move will be. It'll be, if you move here, you will get hit by that guy on the left, but you won't get hit by the guy in front. And instead of, like, the way, you, like, the older school roguelikes work is that when you encounter an enemy, you kind of nudge them to do an attack, and they do an attack back, and often they have a chance to hit and a chance to miss. And so if you die, it's by attrition and bad luck and taking on too many things. Whereas 868 Hack is like, if you can attack them, they can't attack back. You will always win. You can keep hitting them again and again until they die. The only thing is, the longer it takes you to kill them, the longer you're stuck in one's place only attacking them. And if someone attacks you from another side, then you take damage. And you don't take 3 points of damage anyway. So it's very strict and rigid. But there are, obviously, like, there's level layout and stuff. That's totally random. It's beyond your control. But then there's stuff like, there's an ability called Poly, and it just randomizes the types of all the enemies. And it doesn't sound that great at first, because it doesn't give you, like, an inherent advantage necessarily. It doesn't make them weaker enemies. It just changes them. You know, it could change them all to be worse enemies, potentially. But the way you play that game is most of the time you're maneuvering in ways where you can control what's going to happen, and the enemy configurations aren't screwing you. Most of the time the enemies aren't screwing you. It's like, okay, that guy can't get me because he's can't go through walls, and, you know, that guy is really fast, but he's far away. And then every now and then you get in a situation where you're like, oh, fuck. You know, there's no way for me to get away from these two guys. And whatever I do, one of them's going to hit me, even if I kill one of them. And if you use Poly, then it's amazing how often that solves it. Because it's almost always the reason you're fucked is because of one of their special abilities. Like, I'm safe in here, except there's a glitch. And the glitches can go through walls, and so I'm not safe. And if you just randomize it, very unlikely the glitch will be the same enemy. So it doesn't matter what he is then. If he's ultra tough, who cares? He can't get through the wall. If he's ultra fast, who cares? He can't get through the wall. And so it's like a thing that feels like it's going to be a random chance, and it is, but the chances of it doing something good are actually really high, like unexpectedly high. And it's really interesting to, like, sometimes it creates a new problem, but usually it's not as bad a problem as the one you had in the first place.
Haphaz writes in, is it Haphaz? I assume it's short for haphazard. We've had this discussion before. Anyway, sorry. Dear Crowbar Bar Black Sheep, thanks to Tom F's entertaining and engaging game maker tutorials, I've been able to make a game prototype, which is now proudly posted on the forums. Have any of the other Creating Crowbar crew been tempted into giving game programming a go? If so, at what stage do you declare success, failure, or your attention wanders off? Thanks, Haphaz. Or possibly Haphaz. But I like to think Haphaz.
Yeah, I haven't mentioned that before. I'm doing a tutorial for Game Maker, if you want to learn Game Maker. I'm doing a tutorial for it. Look at that, and you'll know.
Where can you find that, Tom?
On my YouTube channel, which we'll link in the show notes.
Yeah. Is that just /pentadact or something?
Yeah,
or
YouTube.com/pentadact. And it's not, it's aimed at total beginners, and it's only like 15 episodes and about half an hour each, so it's not a huge amount of stuff to get through. Mm. And yeah, try and explain everything for people who don't know how to code and stuff. Have either of you attempted such things?
Fuck that. I looked at Game Maker a long time ago, then didn't realise, nah.
I was
tempted to go and use your tutorial series. I will do that, but February has been quite a busy month for me, so. Mm.
I think, I wish I kind of had a grounding in it that, you know, I wish I was coming to it at age 6.
Yeah.
And kind of had, you know, I really wish it was taught in schools it might be soon, so as far as I know, but when I was growing up, we were learning how to do mail merge and Excel spreadsheets.
Yep.
And learning to actually program and make those programs would have been a much, much better use of my...
My class was just rearranging the keys and the keyboards to say, Mr. Cotton smells of cheese.
I remember in an IT class... playing like an annoying buzzing sound through my speaker, and then as the teacher walked around to try and figure out where it was coming from, I would dynamically vary the volume so that it would get quieter as it got closer to me, so it couldn't tell it.
Oh, brilliant.
The IT was taught by the PE teachers in our school for some reason. It was considered like a sort of skillless thing, so it didn't really matter who did it. It would be a teacher who
didn't have any training. Teacher and a biology teacher who did it. Well, biology teacher knew loads, actually.
I was taught history. I was taught the French Revolution by the guy who also taught us rugby. Disastrous. fucking disastrous, unbelievable. Still angry about it. Anyway, yes, I've tried programming. I'm going to go back into it now. I've got like an idea for a prototype that I want to do. And maybe I think prototyping lots of things quickly and fucking up without there being any consequences, or like having a grand vision for a thing, might be a more healthy way to approach it.
Yeah, definitely. Like small scope things are really good. Starting to feel like maybe after heat signature, my next thing won't be as big scope as heat signature. Fucking hell, there's just a lot of moving parts to this. It causes problems with everything. I went to give a talk at a tech camp for kids. It's like a thing you can send your kids to in the holidays to learn more if you want to get them into like an IT or like a tech career, and this was I was told it was just like a class full of kids who were just at this, that's all I knew basically, they were at this tech camp and they, like, their parents are sent them there to, you know, get more into possible tech careers, and so I was there to tell them here's how you can just make a game by yourself, and here's how that could be a career. And I thought, well, the best way to do this is like show them how you make a game. So I actually kind of made like a very brief thing about like balls bouncing around, just talking through the basics of it. Then I found out after I'd given that talk, these like sort of 12-year-old kids, that they had all already made games themselves in a thing called Game Salad, which is like Game Maker's drag and drop thing, basically. So you don't write code, but you organize events and stuff. Most of them are using Minecraft assets in some way. Not because they've been told to, like, they're just, that's, all of them play Minecraft, so that's, like, the first thing. This is going to be a platformer about a creeper who shoots guns. But one girl was basically making Brothers. She's making, like, a game where you have two protagonists and you control them both at the same time with, like...
Huh. Yeah, I do, I don't stay away from this stuff out of any derision for it. It's just, I feel there's a limited time on Earth. I should probably try and be good at the things I'm already good at. But at the same time, I can kind of feel like the wave of my own irrelevancy crashing down upon me. Like, it's already starting to happen, and particularly in gaming, where, 868 Hack is perhaps a bit too niche for this to be a proper example, but certainly the game that... followed on from Bastion, I forget what it's called.
Transistor.
So there's a bunch of games that are coming out that use... like, just the language of coding.
Like Quadrilateral Cowboy.
Yeah, and all these other things. And that's just not something I'm in tune with. And when, you're saying earlier how neat the kind of the language and the effect of 868 Hack is, where you have, you know, glitch and debug. That's like a pun in French for me. It's a pun in a language I don't understand. And I can see that this stuff is beginning to take hold At least in the circles that I move in, and it's only going to spread. And at some point, I'm just not going to understand the world anymore.
Hack and slash.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the more I think about it, the more.
It is, they're all made by fucking nerds. That's
yeah. Yeah. We won't conclude too much about the general populace from this. I think it's mostly...
No, but I mean... you know,
programmers are making...
The people who create the kind of culture, if they have particular interests, then they're also the people who broadcast that
culture.
Yeah,
I'm sure it'll encourage people to get into that stuff.
I hope it does. I do hope it proliferates. I just hope I'm not declared as irrelevant by the singularity and, you know, shuffled into a pit somewhere and burnt.
I think as long as you can always draw a good cock, then your services will be in demand.
People will always need a good cock.
God. Thank God for that. Mental Penguin writes in to say, Heart of Thorns. What is Heart of Thorns, Tom?
It's the first expansion to Guild Wars 2.
He says, Heart of Thorns. Has it persuaded any of you to get back into GW2, which is obviously Guild Wars 2, to start playing it? To give up entirely? Favourite bits? What's the most cataclysmic event you've caused in a game? He goes on to write in a separate tweet. Best adaptation of a board game into a video game and vice versa? He says, really hedging his bets on the number of questions he can get to the podcast. So should we... Heart of Thorns?
I'll take the first one. Yeah, because it exactly did encourage me to go back to Guild Wars 2, and I've got like a level cap, level 80, little tiny dog mongrel creature, necromancer, in Guild Wars 2. And Guild Wars 2 is fucking brilliant. It really is the best MMO. Like, I've started playing Final Fantasy 14 for bizarre reasons earlier in this year, and then, like, I spent £20 on Final Fantasy, and then just played Guild Wars 2. I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing in that other game? I'm just going to play this. Like, it's just more beautiful. It's more kind of generous. Like, it's an MMO where you can just spend an hour in it, and it's very happy for you to do that. There's no subscription fee. It's also, oh, man, it's so good.
Do you play with other people?
Not really much at all, actually. Like, I've soloed almost the entire story. just to see new places in that world. Because it's all about kind of... It's all about ambient adventure. So it's just about wandering through a space and getting pulled into things. It's about being constantly distracted. Instead of picking up a load of quests and then ticking them off as you go around, it's about just kind of moseying along and seeing things and then going, oh, there's a jumping puzzle there and looks like there's something at the top of that mountain. I'll go get it. Mm. And then, oh, there's a big fucking dragon there and there's like literally 70 people fighting it. I'll join in there. And none of this stuff is really gated from you. Like, there's no sense that because I'm level 20, I can't do cool shit like fight big dragons. Yeah. And it really fixes so much of the kind of elitism that's built into MMO design, where you're only allowed to have the real fun. This is true of Destiny through to, you know, early World of Warcraft, where you're only allowed to have the real fun, the real game, when you've put 100 hours into it.
Yeah.
And Guild Wars 2 rejects that completely and says, look, just go and see cool things and do cool things.
Do you have any sense of A, how well Guild Wars 2 did, and B, whether this will actually create new sales for them?
I hope so. It's hard to tell because they have like an in-game microtransaction store, but it's for like purely cosmetic stuff. Mm. And it's still incredibly populated. Like, going back into it's absolutely bustling. I was posting pictures on Twitter of, like, insane high-level characters where there's this enormous kind of guy with a twirly moustache. He's like a giant. He's got two maces with mirror balls on the end. They're kind of beaming, like, laser disco beams all around the place. And he was just standing in the population centre just to go look at my mirror balls. there's still loads of people in it. I mean, I really hope it's been a success. For ArenaNet, and they're obviously still supporting it. And I think there are probably loads of lapsed players who have gone to the end of the story who will be brought back by an expansion.
I have really fond memories of it. I'd like to know how much I played it. I can't remember, like, I don't know if I saw like a played count or anything. Because it's hard to judge. Like, I feel like I saw a lot of places, but I also, when I think about my character, I almost can't remember what it was. I had two. I had like a human female warrior and is it Silvari, the tree people?
Yeah.
One of those who's a rogue, called Special Branch. And I really liked the weapon thing, like how each class you can use, like all the weapons you can use will give you different skills.
Yeah.
And I think I ended up with like a dagger and a torch, and I would do stuff like, I could throw the torch at people and set them alight, and then when they came towards me burning, I could backflip away from them and stab them at the same time and stuff like that. And finding those combinations is really satisfying. And I love the Savari, like, place.
Yeah,
like, they have like a city, and then a bunch of quests around there, and like they have some like way of depicting leafiness that's really convincing to me. So I still like have very vivid memories of that. And also like in terms of like the moment to moment stuff, like combat I liked, but I was mostly sort of interested in like defining interesting combinations, and then once I found those, I wasn't finding it so inherently pleasurable that I was going to do that forever. I was wanted to move on to the next thing. But one system that worked well for like keeping me playing, I don't know if it's a positive or a negative really, but, the fact that, I can't remember exactly how it works, but like every time I logged in, it would give me a reward for finding like 5 resource nodes or whatever, and, or chopping down 5 trees and mining 5 things. And, like for every activity, if you were encouraged to just do a little bit of it, I think it's every hour or something. And if you do that, you get a special reward. And
those are the daily quests. It gives you a list of things, and if you do 3 or 5,
it's not presented like a quest. Like if I'd gone to an NPC and he said, "Go and find 5 bits of wood," I'd be like, "Fuck you." Yeah. But because it was just an inherent ambient thing, like should you come across 5 saplings, then
which you always do, of course, because you're traveling through the world. Yeah, that's kind of how it operates. It stops that dumbass cycle of going back to town and then going back out into the world, and so you actually get to travel. And the locations are extraordinary. Like, there's this eastern area where it's desolated, and there's a huge scar going through the middle of it for this like purple miasma around it, and that's where like a huge dragon crashed through that zone. And if you like once every 36 hours, if you are at the right place, the dragon fucking comes back. And then like you know when it's going to happen, because there are like 150 people there. Like they're like, "Oh, this event's about to tick off, guys. Okay, well," and everyone's on like global chat going, "Dragon's about to spawn, dragon's about to spawn." And it's a really funny kind of conflict between the story of the area, which is really epic, and the kind of casual gaminess of people's chat around it, and the kind of, but you still get like a big epic stupid fight with this ludicrously big dragon. The trouble with a lot of the group events is there's no real tactical, like, significance what you do in them. You're just a part of the Zerg horde, and you just sort of mob the thing and mash your buttons, and there's no like just
there's some kind of like, I mean, it's not just about doing DPS. There's like an agility kind of mini games, and right, you have to kind of get out the attack pattern of the dragon's fire and stuff like that, which I can see why that's entertaining to do multiple times, whereas I think if you just sat there all putting your DPS hits on something until it goes bloop and turns into a treasure chest, then that would be boring. But
I think it does do that. It does have the abilities where it kind of puts templates on the ground. You have to, there's a dodge move in it, which is really important, where you just double tap the move, and if you're a tiny little pug necromancer, you flip miles, sort of miles away from it. And that's really nice. I think most of that stuff is spectacle more than anything. But apparently the dungeons are quite involved, and I've not really done much of that stuff. So that's what I'll be doing when I play a Heart of Thor's expansion. Good video game.
Do you have anything to say about the most cataclysmic event you've caused in the game?
Oh, yeah. Well, I destroyed Europe. when I was playing as Europe in DEFCON.
There's nothing to the Mongols.
Yeah, well, they didn't do that. Well, a few things didn't do that. I played in diplomacy mode, which is where you all start allied, but you can betray anyone at any time, and so it's about like scheming behind people's backs. But I was playing against the AI to see what they do, and they never betray. So eventually I got bored and I had to betray, and of course I was attacked by every single country in the world, fired all of their nukes ever at Europe, and so Europe had 100% coverage of nuclear death. But also in my second Galaxy of Diary, I think I destroy like 85 suns. So that's more, I would say.
Yeah, that's probably worse than Europe.
That's going to win. Yeah, I can't really top that.
No. It's funny how trivial scale is in video games, because I always think of DEFCON when people ask, we've had questions before about like how, what's the most people you've killed or like, things like that. And yeah, DEFCON always comes up with anything. Oh no way, I destroyed those suns as well. And that destroyed whole
solar system. They were just statistics.
I mean, Earth was one of the planets I destroyed. I destroyed Sol, and that, the supernova destroys all of the planets in the solar system as well, as it would.
Yeah.
And so yeah, this planet, I'm afraid, did not make it.
Callous, cold-hearted killer.
I mean, it's such a moot point. Like, you know, you think it's silly that you can do these terribly destructive things and have no emotional connection to them. But how could you ever really, like, even just taking one life is impossible to really make the player.
Well, that's not the problem with video games. There's a problem with human empathy as repeated across centuries and centuries of human endeavour.
I, last week at Paradox, playing a game where I, playing as Nazi Germany, took Poland and, Austria and Lithuania, primarily because I, research really advanced night vision for the Nazis and among other things. And
good job.
Yeah, I didn't feel, I felt satisfied and bad at the same time. Very conflicted about those games, really.
There's a great line in Peep Show. there's an RTS he plays, which I think is you exclusively play as the Germans. And
it's cool now. Yeah, Mark Corrigan.
He's it's one of the few things that is not remotely about gaming, but when they do mention gaming, it's entirely accurate and really insightful.
Yeah. Peep Show, the TV series.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And Mark Corrigan, I think he's being interrupted or something playing it, and he's like, give me a minute, I've got to win this for the Führer. Like that weird sense of obligation that games give you where it's like, achieving this thing is obviously worthwhile because you're being asked to do it. And then when you think about it, I am just winning this for the Nazis, aren't I?
There's a great right after that as well, and it's like focusing on just clicking, and he's like, I don't really know why I'm doing this anymore. It's, it just has to be finished, and I have to be on with my life. And that's also completely accurate for a lot of games where, like, especially in RTSs where there's this cleanup phase.
You've got to finish it. You can't leave it on.
And finally, Menthol Penguin's other question. Best adaptation of board game to a video game and vice versa. Do you think that's happened?
Ooh.
And vice versa. Interesting.
That's a good question.
I helped design the Sir, You're Being Hunted board game.
Oh, awesome.
I have no idea if that was ever printed or sold.
Did you ever play it?
Yeah. Well, I played it with Jim when we were designing it.
Which is better out of the board game and the full game?
The full game.
Board game to video game.
I can only think of... the only one where I've played both would be, I think, Dragon Commander. The Larian series game.
Yeah, right.
Because I was on a, you know, preview trip to play it, and so I played it, played the game there, and then also they were working on the board game at the time, and so we played a prototype version of that in the evening, and so I have played both of those. I think the board game was quite promising, actually. It was quite simple. Like simple, but not a thing I'd played before, which might just be my board game ignorance. But on that basis, maybe the board game of that is better.
I really want to play the XCOM board game. I've not played it yet, but there is one, I think.
Oh, yeah?
I think so.
How's that work?
I don't know. Turn-based aliens, shooting these.
Dice, probably.
Probably isn't.
But somebody takes... It's like a two-player game. One person plays the aliens, one person plays the humans, is what I mean.
I'd assume, but I don't know. I just know it's out there and people like it.
I think the board games I like most have a social element, which is quite difficult to kind of capture in a video game.
Yeah, I'm always like most of the our board game regulars involve lying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like some of you are secretly something, and you've got to lie about being that thing. And there are very few games that really involve that. Video games, I mean.
Twilight Struggle should be the video game, and it's quite possible that it is going to be a video game. I can't remember if it's in development or not, but it was designed by one of the lead designers of Enemy Within, which was the expansion to XCOM Enemy Unknown, and has like annual tournaments.
Is that the one that's it's like the highest rated board game ever?
It's basically it is. Yeah, it's one versus one game about the Cold War.
Yeah, and it's asymmetrical because
it's really asymmetrical. Like there are phases to it where. Like the one faction is really strong in the early game, but really weak in the late game. It's kind of amazing. there are also so many fucking tokens that it should be a video game. Like it's kind of a hassle to play. Like so many. It's like Solium Infernum, which is basically a board game in digital form, but you'd never want it to be a board game because there are so many tokens involved. And
that guy is making board games.
Which is really
cool. He's switched.
Vic Davis.
Yeah. It didn't sound like a happy thing, did it? It sounded like he was sort of decided he couldn't make computer games anymore.
Yeah.
He said something about, like, it just was technically incapable of doing it. Like, he seemed to feel that they'd moved on so much that he couldn't keep up.
Yeah, that was the tone of the blog post he used to.
But I don't know. Have they really? I mean, I'm working in Game Maker, so I'm biased.
not for that niche, I don't think. I think for people who love those games, like they can look. They always had like a. I don't know. Maybe that's just suited to the universe he was trying to portray. I don't know what it was, but like, I just think he would make a fucking amazing board game.
Yeah.
Like, because all his games are basically just slightly overcomplicated board games. Hmm. I'm really excited.
JCD Bionic Man.
That says, is the login details for your computer in DevX.
Oh, sure. Oh, my God. Either it's deja vu, or he has written it before and you said exactly the same thing.
That is the kind of information I just recite on rote.
Well, you have a few beers in you, you know, so it's fine.
If I know that, I can't not say it.
Deus Ex, come on.
He asks, is the arena shooter dead? And then answers his own question. If so, what's with all these new ones showing up? And what does the future hold for Quake Live? There are loads of new arena shooters, particularly on early access. There's loads of good ones. One called Toxic, which looks fucking great, and I still haven't played it. Even though
Marsh, you should play Reflex.
That looks really nice.
Fucking brilliant. It's just
that looks just exactly like Quake 3.
It is, and it's
whereas it was like Toxic is Unreal Tournament 2K4, and that is Quake 3 basically.
Yeah, and I'm totally cool with that. Also, like I played the prototype, which is it looks just like it's quite slick actually, but it's all about the feeling of movement, the lightning fast, completely responsive movement, and the speed that you have from those games that shooters completely lost. And it's about time it was resurrected en masse.
I worry that I'm going to go back to those kind of games which I used to love I was of that age. Mm. I'm not going to have anything like the reaction that I did. It's going to feel like
suffering synapses will not be able to keep up with the pace of the games. But maybe if we only ever play with each other.
Yeah, that would be fine.
And then we'll be on parity forever. That'd be great.
But yeah, I don't think the arena shooter is dead. I think there's lots of games coming out soon which are bringing it right back. I don't know about Quake Live though.
I don't know what the population is like.
There's an Unreal Tournament game being made.
Yeah,
exactly. Indeed, yeah.
Quite probably.
Mm. And a good thing that is too.
Yeah, it's good because The FPS has lost mobility when it went into its military phase.
Yeah, that's true. They're not about movement anymore, are they?
No, apart from Titanfall's kind of bringing that back, but I think we'll see more and more of that, like, you know, tribes-esque.
Oh, Toxic has this great video, which is just a list of things that it doesn't have in it.
Oh, wow.
From modern shooters. So there's, you know, there's no fucking upgrade tree, there's no XP, none of this stuff.
That's a good concept trailer.
Yeah, really good.
I'll play that.
And that is all the questions that we have this week, and also all the time that we're going to spend this evening talking to you about video games.
You can write us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet at us at crateandcrowbar, and you can tweet or follow us individually. I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I'm at Marsh Davies, which is DAVIES.
I'm at PCG Ludo, LUDO.
Thanks for listening, everybody!